We're used to using the word play when it comes to music making. Musicians play their pieces. But we're about to hear a play-by-play from a musician within an ensemble while they're actually playing the music. In this case, it's a string quartet by Franz Schubert titled Death and the Maiden. And violinist Arnold Steinhardt of the Guarneri Quartet is commenting on the playing as he and his colleagues John Daly violin, Michael Tree viola, and David Sawyer cello are in the thick of it. We enter stage left, we bow, we take our seats, and we assume our expected roles in the drama that will unfold in the next 40 minutes. We begin one long, powerful chord, followed by four short, hammered strokes. Judgment Day has arrived, he says. The opening movement runs its dark and troubled course. Opening movement runs its dark and troubled course, finally yielding to the centerpiece, the second movement, Death and the Maiden itself. Steinhardt talks to himself. Give a good lead, Arnold, distinct but soft, so that we can start together and set the stage for Death's words to the Maiden. In four-part harmony, we begin the solemn theme softly. Decent blend. Together. Good. Watch John's fingers. Eat them, as Sascha Schneider once advised us. We repeat the first eight bars. Not the same, but not too different either. David's bow floats more this time. Nice. Match that sound. We move into the theme's second part, cautiously measuring our crescendo from pianissimo to forte together. More bow, less sound on the 16th notes. It is the heart speaking, not the violin notes. We take courage in the variation's second half, roaring to a forte, then subsiding. But my last notes are too free. John has to stand on his head to follow me. Oh, sorry, John. Thanks, John. The cello variation is upon us. Don't follow David's lead. Instead, watch his third finger, which lifts up for an instant before he puts it down to play. Imagine that. We're with him. No time for self-congratulations. David is now the rhapsodic soloist. We, the little wheels and springs of a fine watch that must be timed to him. Tonight, David ignores our plight and goes on a flight of fancy. How are we supposed to follow him and play together at the same time? David's free flight is impressive, and we somehow manage to hang on. But it scares me every time. Near the end, we follow John's motion, eating his fingers again. One last crescendo, tries to take wing, cannot, and then the final chord of the movement fades away. I give the cue that brings all our bows gently to a halt. There is silence, the silence of being too filled with something. Schubert's grip on us slackens, and we are gradually restored to this world. The faces of David, Michael, and John come back into focus. We four are in the midst of a great and wonderful journey. Words of violinist Arnold Steinhardt of the Guarneri Quartet in his memoir, Indivisible by Four, giving us an insider's guide to a concert performance of Schubert's string quartet titled Death and the Maiden. Steinhardt has given us a sense of the dance that is making chamber music like this. The group has been together so long, they respect and trust each other so much, that when cellist David Sawyer is inspired in the moment there on stage to, as Steinhardt describes it, a flight of fancy, the others are challenged, but they cope and respond, and the audience gets an electrifying moment, a one-of-a-kind moment, the mark of a mature ensemble at its best. And that may explain in part why these players did what they did for so many years. As it happens, Evelyn Estava and her colleagues in the Madison String Quartet have been together for almost 2 decades, and they know the exhilaration of playing such monumental pieces as the Schubert Quartet, Death and the Maiden, and discovering the joys of introducing freshly composed works to their listeners, and of even listening, in fact, to Arnold Steinhardt himself in coaching sessions. We just heard how a musician is, in a way, inside the music, and that is how violinist Evelyn Estava grew up in the musical culture of her native Venezuela. She and the other members of the Madison Quartet will return to the Dietrich Theater in Tunkhannock this Sunday with the mighty Death and the Maiden Quartet by Schubert, and much more. Back by popular demand on Mother's Day. We had a chance to speak by phone with Evelyn, and because the concert is on Mother's Day, we began with her own family.
Music was there always. It wasn't just my mother. It was, you know, my father has always been a music lover. He was an informal piano player. Like, he learned it by ear, and he played Latin music and stuff. My mother was more the classical stuff, but you know, we listened to a lot of music at home, all kinds of music, classical and folk and, you know, Venezuelan folk and American folk and, you know, rock and roll and salsa. It was a pretty eclectic library that we had.
Was radio part of the picture? Did you have an active radio listening habit as well?
Oh, yeah. My mother always listened to the classical music station, and it was always in the car. And she drove us to school every day because, you know, the system is a little different in Venezuela. And then because we were in a smaller school where she was working, you know, it was a little farther away. So it's not like we could walk to school. So she always drove us to school and back. And, yeah, that's always Radio Nacional de Venezuela. That was the classical music station that we listened to. And when we had dinner, my father would always put a record of, you know, either Strauss waltzes or Chopin. You know, everybody asked me, how do you like Chopin so much? You're not a pianist. I was like, well, I kind of grew up listening to it.
When did you first pick up an instrument of any kind?
Well, we had a piano in the house. And, of course, since we were little, we were always, like, tinkling at the keys and always trying to play a little tune here and there. And then as we got to school age, there's an instrument that we have in Venezuela called the cuatro, which is, I would say, it's kind of like an oversized ukulele. And everybody kind of learns it because it's a national instrument and you learn it. And you start to kind of like play songs by yourself. My mother also had a guitar and we kind of played with that as well. And when I went to music school, and, you know, the system there is that you take a year of theory in solfège so that you're able to read music before you pick an instrument. And at the beginning, I just wanted piano like my mom. Like, oh, I want to play this piano like my mom. And then, you know, the piano classes were awful. And they said, well, you have to pick another instrument. And so I said, well, how about the cello? And they said, sure, but the cello teacher just died. So you have to either wait a year or pick another instrument. So violin was actually my third choice. And yes, that's how I started playing the violin. And at the beginning, it was a little difficult because the violin is not an instrument or string instruments in general. There's no immediate satisfaction as you get with the piano or the guitar, where, you know, like half an hour into the lesson, you're already playing a little tune, right? But to make a stringed instrument sound, even start to sound like you can play a little tune in it, it takes a little longer. You have to have a lot of patience, which I didn't at that time. You know, you learn to have patience because it's the only way that you can get better at the instrument, but patience is definitely not my middle name. So it was a little bit of a struggle at the beginning. But once you start realizing how wonderful this thing can be and how it can change your life, you go like, okay, I could do this.
And it did change your life.
Absolutely it did. Absolutely it did. I don't know. I remember that when I was a child, you know, everybody wants to be a doctor. And, you know, I wanted to be an anthropologist and I wanted to go. To this day, I don't know where my life would be without music or without, you know, my instrument. But I don't see myself doing anything else.
And what about the culture in Venezuela in terms of music as an important aspect of your identity as a citizen? Because you do have the national effort to educate young people. It's different here, right?
Well, yeah, and it's funny because when we Venezuelans, and I think that this happens in a lot of cultures, and, you know, you see it all through Latin America, you see it all through, you know, Africa, but it's a very, very musical culture, and we're always making up songs about things, and music is ingrained in our DNA, I think, and kids from a very small age are singing folk songs and that kind of stuff. And, you know, just the influences that this country has, that Venezuela has, in the sense of the African diaspora and the Spanish and the Moors. And there's so much going on that there was a kind of like a primordial soup of music there. And it just made for a very musical, not just citizen, but just very musical people. There's music everywhere and people play anything and sing anything. And I think one of the reasons that the education program has been successful is that because it's harnessed all that innate musicality and just honed it.
What drew you to the States?
Well, my mother was American, and I had been working in Venezuela for a long time. I was teaching in the conservatory. I was assistant concertmaster of an orchestra. I kind of hit a glass ceiling, to be perfectly honest. And things got a little frustrating work-wise, and I decided to try my luck. And I said, well, if Frank Sinatra says, if you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. I kind of wanted to measure myself in this very competitive area and see how it stacked up. So that was part of what drew me here.
And I love the connections of geography. Of course, your home, Venezuela, and then you came and you got together with these wonderful friends in music who are your colleagues, and you named the quartet after the place right in New Jersey where you were, Madison?
Right. The name of the quartet, it's funny because when we started, we were like, well, what are we going to name this thing. All kinds of names popped up, and I don't know. And we were working at the university, which is in Madison. And we were closely associated with them as kind of quartet in residence, because two of us were teaching there. So I was like, why not just Madison? Madison String Quartet. You know, it's kind of got a ring to it. And it's funny that you asked that question, because, you know, a couple of years later, we had some coachings with Arnold Steinhardt of the Guarneri Quartet. And he's just a wonderful musician and just such a delightful person and so knowledgeable. And so it was really a privilege to work with him. But, you know, at the end of one of our coachings that we had with him, he's like, well, what do you call yourself? Well, we call ourselves the Madison String Quartet. He said, that's a great name, because people will think that they've already heard of you. Because it is a name that's kind of, it's special enough, but it's ordinary enough that people, oh, yeah, I know the Madison String Quartet. So, yeah, it was so he liked it, so we kept it.
And what are some of the things that he might have brought to your attention?
Well, so many things. It's just playing in a quartet, it's a microcosm of music, and it's one of the most, it's one of the most difficult, because there's no conductor to tell you, you want to do this, or we should this, we should do that. There's no piano to tell you, okay, this is how you play. You know, you have to play in tune with the piano. So we have to tune with ourselves. We have to come to an agreement on what we want to do musically. And in that sense, Mr. Steinhardt was really, really great. And every time we have a coaching with somebody or we play with somebody, we always try to learn whatever we can from whoever gives us a critique or a coaching or whatever. And I think that's what's kept us together for so many years. That and the fact that we respect and admire each other as musicians. Because I don't know if you know this, but it will be next year is going to be our 20th anniversary. And for a string quartet to be together for so long, there has to be something that really glues us together, because there's so many stories of so many different quartets that have been wonderful and amazing, and then 3 years later they break up. And it's difficult to keep a quartet going for such a long time. There are many groups who have done it, but the percentage is lower. I think it's lower than other groups, just because it's that difficult. And it's funny, because we think ourselves as a married quartet, because we kind of know each other's quirks already. And what we need to do is just keeping not just the respect and the admiration, but also not letting each other get too comfortable. So the idea is also to keep challenging yourself and your colleagues to do better, to go somewhere else, to get a coaching with so-and-so, to play in this place, to play in the other place, to try this repertoire that we've never done before. And it's what keeps us together, really. And it's my favorite thing to do is play quartet.
And what are you bringing to the Dietrich this year?
We are bringing a really nice program. We're opening with a little quartet by Mozart. It's one of his earlier quartets, K-156. And then we're going to follow up with a beautiful piece by Joaquín Turina, who is a Spanish composer. And this piece is called La Oración del Torero, The Bullfighter's Prayer. And it's just very atmospheric. It's like Spanish Debussy, if you will. Very atmospheric, kind of French-like, but very Spanish. And after that, we're going to play a little medley of, because it's the centennial, we're going to play a little medley of Bernstein tunes from West Side Story. And those tunes have been arranged by our dear friend Dave Remelis, whose music you heard at the Dietrich last year. And Dave, these arrangements of these four tunes from West Side Story, it's Cool, I Feel Pretty, Somewhere, and America. And so that will take you to the break with a little bit of a dance there. And then the second half is one of the mainstays, one of the powerhouses of the string quartet literature, is the quartet by Franz Schubert called Death and the Maiden. It is an incredible piece. And that piece, along with the late Beethoven, it's pretty much a Mount Everest of quartet literature. And we've played it in our history as a quartet. We've played it, I think this will be our third or fourth time playing it. And it's just so fantastic. And every time we see it, something different happens. It's a great, wonderful piece. And it's based on a song that Schubert wrote called Death and the Maiden. And the centerpiece of the quartet is the second movement, because the second movement has the theme, Death and the Maiden. And it plays the tune, and it makes a whole bunch of variations on it. And in that sense, it reminds me a lot of the Beethoven Opus 132 quartet. You know, the centerpiece of it is another theme with variations, the Heiligen Dankesang. So I think that's the real, the whole quartet is very meaty, but it's just so beautiful. And it's so full of the Schubert melodies that have been so iconic. And it's just a wonderful piece to play, perform, and to listen to. So I'm hoping that the audience will enjoy this.
When you set about tackling something like the Schubert Quartet, for example, even if you're coming back to it having done it before, do you read through it and then say, let's go to this spot? What would be a typical way of getting into something so significant as a piece like this?
Well, what we usually do when we are playing a new piece that we have played before, we just play through one movement and see how it feels, and we see how it's changed since the last time we played it. And then we start working, and then we go, and then we read the second movement, and then we start working. And what we do is every rehearsal, for example, we have our email thread, look, this thing here for Monday, for example, because this is another thing we do as a quartet. We take turns rehearsing in each other's house, and whoever hosts must provide lunch. So it's a little bit of a gastronomic endeavor as well. But for example, I can say tomorrow rehearsals at my house will work, you know, the third movement of the Schubert and the Turina, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll do the fourth movement of the Schubert. And if there's time, we'll do a little bit of the first, and then making red lentil soup. That would be an example of an exchange. But coming back to a piece like the Schubert is always amazing, because it's always a discovery. It's always a discovery. And whoever says that classical music, da-da-da, you're playing the same thing all of... No. Every time you play a piece like this is a new discovery. And it's what makes these pieces eternal, basically.
As you just suggested, this piece has as its centerpiece the movement based on the song. Is there a sense that just Schubert as a composer can't help himself having the lyric line? Is there something as you play that you keep in mind? I'm sure you do it in everything you play, about the human voice in a piece like this.
Absolutely. There is something about the lyrical quality of Schubert's writing, especially his chamber music. It's so connected to his leader and, you know, all the songs that he wrote. And you kind of know how to tackle, or you get like a sense of who he is as a composer by listening to the songs. And that is so helpful for us to know all of this, and to know that basically everything he wrote is a song. It's like, you know, that saying that says that, you know, everything Mozart wrote is an opera, and everything Tchaikovsky wrote is a ballet. And it's a bit of a generalization, but it is accurate in more cases than not. So absolutely, knowing and listening to the song and of course, reading the poem, it makes you make so much sense of what's on the page. And yeah, and this is what we do with string instruments. We always want to imitate the human voice, no matter how. And listening to songs, listening to the human voice singing, is something at least that I strive for in my violin playing as far as phrasing goes. Because you can play something in a completely different way. And I do this with my students, actually. When they cannot really connect to the music that they're playing, I just take out the fiddle from their hands and say, sing it. And you wouldn't believe how much that changes the approach. So it's really, really a special moment when you get to translate all of that into a piece as monumental, but also as lyrical as Schubert's Death in the Mating Quartet.
Violinist Evelyn Esteva is recognized as one of the top performing artists in her native Venezuela. She has made many guest appearances with orchestras in North and South America, including the Mexico State Symphony and the Simon Bolivar Orchestra of Venezuela. She is the first violinist of the Madison Quartet, with violinist Rebecca Harris-Lee, violinist violist Michael Valdeono, and cellist Gerald Heiser. And the Madison Quartet will return to the Dietrich Theater in Tunkhannock this Sunday for a free Mother's Day performance at 3 o'clock. And on the program, as we heard, Mozart's quartet, Kirschel 156, La Oración del Torero of Joaquín Turina, a medley of tunes from West Side Story by Leonard Bernstein, and The Great Death and the Maiden Quartet by Franz Schubert. That's the Madison String Quartet returning to the Dietrich Theater in Tunkhannock, 60 East Tioga Street, and it's Mother's Day, Sunday, May 13th at 3 o'clock. The concert is free, but they would be pleased to accept a donation. For more information on the web, dietrichtheater.com, dietrichtheater.com, and Dietrich is spelled D-I-E-T-R-I-C-H. And theater is T-E-R, the final three letters, T-E-R, DietrichTheater.com. The Madison String Quartet, Sunday, May 13th at 3 o'clock at the Dietrich Theater, 60 East Tioga Street in Tunkhannock, on the web, DietrichTheater.com.